Chapter 1. Krondor. Eric signalled. The soldiers knelt just below his position in the gully, watching as he silently motioned where he wanted each of them. Alfred, now his first corporal, gestured from the far end of the line, and Eric nodded. Each man knew what to do. The enemy had camped in a relatively defensible position on the trail north of Krondor. About 3 miles up the road was the small town of Egli, the objective of the invaders. The enemy had stopped their march before sundown, and Eric was certain they would launch an attack just before dawn. Eric had watched them from his hidden vantage, his men camped a short distance away while he decided his best course of action. He had observed the enemy erect their camp and saw they had been as disorganized as he had suspected they would be. Their pickets were placed poorly and were undisciplined, spending as much time looking into the camp to chat with comrades as actually watching for an enemy approach. The constant glances in the direction of the campfires were certainly diminishing their night vision. After gauging the strength and position of the invaders, Eric knew his choices. He had decided to strike first. While outnumbered by at least 5 to 1, his men would have the advantage of surprise and superior training. At least, he hoped the latter was true. Eric took a moment for one last inspection of the enemy's position. If anything, the pickets were even more inattentive than they had been when Eric had sent for his company. It was clear the invaders thought their mission one of minor importance, taking a small town off the beaten track, while major conflicts would be raging to the south near the capital city of Krondor. Eric was determined to teach them that there were no minor conflicts in any war. When his men were in place, Eric slipped down a small defile until he was almost within touching distance of a bored guard. He tossed a small stone behind the man, who looked without thought. As Eric knew would be the case, the man glanced back into the camp at the nearest campfire, which blinded him for a moment. A soldier, sitting near the fire, said,
"What is it, Henry?"
The guard said,
"Nothing."
He turned to find Eric standing directly before him, and faster than he could shout alarm, Eric hit him with his bald fist, catching him as he fell.
"Henry?"
said the man at the campfire, starting to rise, vainly trying to see into the gloom beyond the campfire light. Eric attempted to imitate the guard's voice.
"I said nothing."
The attempt failed, for the soldier started to shout alarm and pulled on his sword. But before he could clear the blade from his scabbard, Eric was upon him like a cat on a mouse. Grabbing the man by the back of his tunic, Eric pulled him over backward, slamming him hard into the ground. Putting a dagger at the man's throat, he said,
"You're dead. No noise."
The man gave him a sour look, but nodded. Softly, he said,
"Well, at least I'll get to finish my supper."
He sat up and returned to his dinner plate, while two other men blinked in incomprehension as Eric circled the campfire and cut each of their throats before they realized an attack was underway. Shouts from around the camp announced that the rest of Eric's company was now in force among the enemy, cutting throats, knocking down tents, and generally creating havoc. The only prohibition Eric had put on them was no fires. Although tempted, he thought the Baron of Tyr Sog would not appreciate the damage to his baggage. Eric hurried through the struggle, dispatching sleeping soldiers as they emerged from tents. He cut a few ropes, trapping soldiers inside as the canvas fell upon them, and heard shouts of outrage from within. Throughout the camp, men cursed as they were killed, and Eric could hardly contain his amusement. The strike was fast, and he was at the centre of the camp within 2 minutes of the start of the assault. He reached the command tent as the Baron came out,
obviously half asleep as he buckled his sword belt around his nightshirt, and clearly displeased by the disruption.
"What have we here?"
he demanded of Eric.
"Your company's destroyed, my lord," said Eric, with a light tap of his sword upon the Baron's chest. "And you are now dead."
The Baron studied the man who was sheathing his sword. He was tall, unusually broad across the shoulders, without being fat, like a young blacksmith, with unremarkable features. His smile was engaging, however, friendly and open. In the firelight, his pale blonde hair danced with ruby highlights.
"Nonsense!" said the stout Baron.
His neatly trimmed beard and fine silk nightshirt said volumes about his campaign experience.
"We were to attack Egli tomorrow. No one said anything about this, sir."
He waved his hand around the campsite.
"Business of a night attack. Had we known, we would have taken precautions."
Eric said, "My lord, we're attempting to prove a point." A voice came out of the darkness.
"And you proved it well."
Owen Greylock, knight captain of the Prince of Krondor's royal garrison, came into the light. His gaunt features gave him a sinister appearance in the dancing shadows of the firelight.
"I judge you've killed or incapacitated 3/4 of the soldiers, Eric. How many men did you bring?"
Eric said, 60.
"But I have 300, said the Baron, clearly disturbed, "with an auxiliary of Hadati warriors."
Eric glanced about and said, "I don't see any Hadati." From out of the dark came an accented voice,
"As it should be."
A group of men dressed in kilts and plaids entered the camp. They wore their hair tied up high atop their heads in a knot, with a long fall of it spilling down their backs.
"We heard your men approaching," said the leader, looking at Eric, who wore an unmarked black tunic, and guessing at his rank. "Captain."
"Sergeant," corrected Eric.
"Sergeant,"
amended the spokesman, a tall warrior who wore only a simple sleeveless tunic above his kilt. His plaid would provide warmth in the mountains if unrolled and worn around his shoulders. Below night-black hair, his features were even, nothing out of the ordinary, save for dark eyes that reminded Eric of a bird of prey. In the campfire light, his sun-darkened skin was almost red. Eric didn't need to see the man draw the long blade he wore on his back to know him for a seasoned fighter.
"You heard us?" asked Eric. "Yes. Your men are good, Sergeant, but we Hadati live in the mountains, often sleeping on the ground near our herds, and we know when we're hearing a group of men approach."
"What's your name?"
asked Eric. "Aki, son of Bandor."
Eric nodded.
"We need to talk."
The Baron said,
"I protest, Captain."
Greylock said, "What, my lord?"
"I protest this unannounced action. We were told to play the role of invaders and expect resistance by local militia and special units from Krondor at the town of Egli. Nothing was said of a night attack. Had we known, we would have prepared for such," he repeated.
Eric glanced at Owen, who signalled that Eric should form up his company and depart, while the prince's knight captain soothed the ruffled feelings of the Baron of Tyr Sog. Eric motioned Aki to his side and said,
"Have your men gather their kits and find my corporal. He's a nasty-looking thug named Alfred. Tell him you'll be coming with us to Krondor in the morning."
"Will the Baron approve?" asked Aki.
"Probably not," answered Eric, turning away. "But he doesn't have much to say about it. I'm the Prince of Krondor's man."
The Hadati hillman shrugged and motioned to his companions.
"Let those men free."
"Free?"
asked Eric. Aki smiled. We captured a few of those you sent to the south, Sergeant. I believe your ugly thug may be among them.
Eric let fatigue and the pressure of the night's exercise get the better of his usually calm nature. Swearing softly, he said,
"If he is, he'll regret it."
Aki shrugged, turning to his companions and saying,
"Let's go see."
Eric addressed another of his company, a soldier named Shane.
"Get the men formed up at the south end of the camp."
Shane nodded and started shouting orders. Eric followed the Hadati to a point outside the perimeter of the Baron's camp and found a pair of Hadati sitting next to Corporal Alfred and a half dozen of Eric's best men.
"What happened?" Eric asked.
Alfred sighed as he stood.
"They're good, Sergeant."
He pointed to a ridge above them.
"They must have moved the second they heard us coming, 'cause we were up there on that ridge, and I would have wagered everything I own it wasn't possible they could have come up out of that camp, crossed the ridge, lay low, then come up behind us as we headed down."
He shook his head.
"We were being tapped on the shoulder before we heard 'em."
Eric turned to Aki.
"You'll have to tell me how you did that."
Aki shrugged, saying nothing. To Alfred, Eric said,
"These hillmen are coming with us. Take them down to the camp and let's get back to Krondor."
Alfred smiled, forgetting the tongue-lashing he was likely to receive from Eric when they were back at the garrison.
"Hot meal," he said.
Eric was forced to agree it would be welcome. They had been out on manoeuvres for a week, eating cold rations in the dark, and his men were tired and hungry.
"Get moving,"
was all he said. Standing in the dark, Eric considered what was at stake in the impending war, and wondered if 100 such exercises would prepare the men of the kingdom for what was to come. Tossing aside such concern, he conceded that probably nothing would prepare them fully. But what other choice did he have? He considered that Kaelis, Prince Patrick, Knight Marshal William, and other commanders were operating throughout these mountains, conducting such exercises this week. At the end of the week, a council would be held to tally what needed to be done. Eric said to himself,
Everything needs to be done.
And he realized his black mood was due more to fatigue and hunger than to Alfred's failing to avoid the Hadati ambush. Then he smiled. If the hillmen from northern Yabon had gotten up over that ridge that fast, it was a good thing they were going to be on the kingdom's side, and even better, thought Eric, under his command. He turned toward the camp and decided he'd better join Greylock in mollifying the distressed Baron of Tyr Sog. The soldiers stood to attention as the courtyard resounded with the echo of their boot heels striking cobbles as one, and each man stood motionless while the Prince of Krondor made his appearance on the dais. Rue looked at his friend Eric and said,
"Nicely done."
Eric shook his head, indicating that Rue should keep silent. Rue grinned, but stayed quiet, while Prince Patrick, ruler of Krondor, accepted a salute from the assembled garrison of the palace. Next to Eric stood Kaelis, captain of the prince's special guards, known as the Crimson Eagles. Eric shifted his weight slightly, uncomfortable with the attention being drawn to him and the others. The survivors of the most recent expedition to the distant land of Nevindus were being presented with awards for bravery, and Eric wasn't sure what that entailed, but he knew he would prefer being back about his usual duties. He had returned from the exercises in the mountains expecting a quick council, but Kaelis had informed Eric and the others that with Prince Erland's return from a visit to his brother King Boric, a ceremony was scheduled and awards would be conferred, but beyond that, Eric knew little. He glanced sideways and saw his captain, Kaelis, also looking impatient to see the fuss over with. Rinaldo, one of the other survivors, turned to look at Misha. Both soldiers had accompanied Kalis on their flight from the halls of the Pantathian serpent priests. Rinaldo had his chest puffed out as the Prince of Krondor presented him with an award, the White Cord of Courage, which would be sewn to his tunic sleeve, marking him a man who displayed conspicuous bravery for king and country. Rue had sailed one of his largest ships to Navindus to bring the kingdom soldiers home. Eric and his companions had rested and healed on the return journey. Their captain, the enigmatic man reputed to be a half-elf, was almost completely recovered from injuries that would have killed any other man. Two old companions of his, Praji and Vaja, had died in the magical blast that had caught Kalis, and half his body had been burned as if set on fire. Yet he hardly showed the slightest scar, his face and neck only marked by flesh just a little lighter in colour than the rest of his sun-bronzed skin. Eric wondered if he would ever know the full truth about the man he served. And, thinking of enigmas, Eric regarded another of his companions over the last few years, the odd gambler Nakor. He stood apart from those being honoured, a half-mocking grin on his face as he watched the award ceremony. At his side stood Sho Pai, the former monk who now regarded himself as Nakor's acolyte. They had been residing in the palace as the guests of the Duke of Krondor for the last month, Nakor showing little motivation to return to his usual occupation, fleecing the unsuspecting in card rooms across the kingdom. Eric let his mind wander as the prince sighted each man, and he wondered who would honour those who were left behind, particularly Bobby de Loungeville, the iron-tough, unforgiving sergeant, who, more than any other, had forged Eric into the soldier he had become. Eric felt a tear gather in his eye as he recalled holding Bobby in the ice cave in the mountains as his lungs filled with blood from a sword wound. Silently, Eric said to himself, "See, I got him out alive." Blinking away the tear, Eric once again glanced at Kalis and found the captain watching him. With a barely perceptible nod, Kalis seemed to say he knew what Eric was thinking, and was also remembering lost friends. The ceremony dragged on, then suddenly it was over. The assembled garrison of the palace in Krondor dismissed. Knight Marshal William, military commander of the principality, motioned for Eric and the others to attend him. To Kalis he said, "The prince asks you all to join him in his private council room." Eric glanced at Rue, who shrugged. On the return voyage, the two boyhood friends had caught up with each other's news. Eric had been half amused, half astonished, to discover that his best friend had, in less than 2 years, contrived to become one of Krondor's preeminent merchants, and one of the kingdom's richest men. But as he saw the ship's master and crew snap to every order Rue gave, he realized that Rupert Avery, barely more than a common thief as a child, and hardly more than a boy now, truly owned that ship. Eric had told Rue of what he and the others had discovered, and he needed no embellishment to convey the horror and disgust he felt at fighting through the Pantathian birthing halls. Of those who had not travelled to Navindus with Kalis on his most recent journey, Rue, Nakor, and Sho Pai had been there previously, and knew what the others faced. Slowly, over the voyage, Eric had provided enough grisly details about the slaughter of Pantathian females and infants, as well as about the mysterious third player, who had accomplished more carnage than Kalis's raiders ever could have done. Unless there were birthing creches located elsewhere, and it seemed unlikely, the only living Pantathians were those close to the Emerald Queen. If they were finally defeated in the coming battle, the Pantathian serpent priests would cease to exist, a fate most fervently hoped for by the two boyhood friends from Darkmoor. Rue and Eric had parted almost as soon as the ship had berthed, as Rue had businesses to oversee. 2 days later, Eric had left on manoeuvres, evaluating the training Jado Shati had inflicted upon the men in training, while Kalis had been gone. Eric was pleased that the new men under his command, for the last week, were as disciplined and reliable as those he had trained with when he had been a common soldier. Entering the palace, Eric was again uncomfortable at finding himself in the halls of power and in the presence of the great of the kingdom. He had served for a year in Krondor before leaving with Kalis on the last voyage, but had confined himself to the training grounds most of the time. He came to the palace proper only when summoned or to borrow a book on tactics or some other aspect of warcraft from Knight Marshal William. He was never comfortable with the supreme commander of the King's armies of the West, but he finally grew used to spending hours over ale or wine discussing what he had read and how it would bear on the armies he was helping to fashion. But, given a choice, Eric would rather be in the drilling yard, working with the armourers around the forge, or tending to the horses, or, most of all, out in the field, where life was too demanding to think much about the larger consequences of the coming war. In the prince's private chamber, actually, Eric thought, a small hall, other men waited, including Lord James, Duke of Krondor, and Jado Shati, the other sergeant in Kalis's company. Eric expected Jado would be promoted to Sergeant Major to replace Bobby. Upon the table, a lavish board of cheeses, meats, fruit, bread, and vegetables had been laid out. Ale, wine, and frosted pitchers of fruit juices were also waiting. "Set to," said the Prince of Krondor, removing his ceremonial crown and mantle and handing them to waiting pages. Kalis picked up an apple and bit into it, while others moved around the table. Eric motioned to Rue, who came over to him. "How did you find things at home?" Eric asked. Rue said, "The children are amazing. They've grown so much in the months I was gone, I scarcely recognize them." His face creased in a thoughtful expression. "My business endured my absence well enough, though not as well as I'd expected. Jacob Esterbrook had the better of me 3 times while I was gone. One transaction cost me a small fortune." "I thought you and he were friends," said Eric, taking a bite of bread and cheese. "In a manner of speaking," said Rue. He had thought better of mentioning his relationship to Sylvia Esterbrook, Jacob's daughter, given that Eric tended to have a narrow view of family and vows of faithfulness. "Friendly competitors would be a more accurate description. He has a stranglehold on trade to Kesh, and seems reluctant to relinquish even a small part of it." Kalis came up to them and said, "Rue, will you excuse us a moment?" Rupert nodded, said, "Of course, Captain," and walked over to the table to take advantage of the fare. Kalis waited until they were out of earshot before he asked, "Eric, has Marshal William had a chance to talk to you today?" Eric shook his head. "No, Captain. I was busy getting back into the rhythm of things with Jado, now that Bobby's no longer here." He shrugged.
"I understand."
Kalis turned and motioned for the Knight Marshal, who joined them. Kalis looked at Eric.
"You've got a choice."
William, a short, slender man, whom Eric knew to be one of the best riders and swordsmen in the kingdom, despite his advancing age, said, "Kalis and I have talked about you, youngster. With things as they are, we have more opportunities than we have men with talent." Eric knew what William had meant by things as they are, for he knew that a terrible army was massing across the sea and would be invading in less than 2 years' time.
"Choice, I'd like to offer you a staff position," said William. "You'd hold the rank of knight lieutenant in the prince's army, and I'd put you in charge of the Crondorian heavy lance. Your skill with horses, well, I can't think of a better man for the job."
Eric glanced at Kalis.
"Sir?"
"I'd like you to stay with the Crimson Eagles," said Kalis in a flat tone.
"Then I'll stay," said Eric without hesitation. "I made a promise."
William smiled ruefully.
"I thought as much, but I had to ask."
"Thank you for asking, my lord," said Eric. "I'm flattered." William grinned at Kalis.
"You must use magic. He's halfway to being the best tactician I've ever met, and if he keeps studying, he'll be the best. And you want to waste him as a bully sergeant."
Kalis smiled slightly, an expression of wry amusement Eric had come to know well. The half-elven captain said,
"We have more need of bully sergeants to train soldiers right now than we do tacticians, Willie. Besides, my bully sergeants are not the same as yours."
William shrugged.
You're right, of course. But when they come, each of us is going to want the best we can find at our side."
"I can't argue that."
William left, and Kalis said,
"Eric, thank you."
Eric repeated,
"I made a promise."
"To Bobby?"
asked Kalis. Eric nodded. Kalis's expression darkened.
"Well, knowing Bobby, I'd best tell you now, I need a sergeant major, not a nursemaid. You kept me alive once, Eric von Darkmoor, so consider your promise to Bobby de Loungeville discharged in full. If it comes to a choice between my life and the survival of the kingdom, I want you to make the right choice."
It took Eric a moment to comprehend what had just been said.
"Sergeant Major?"
"You're taking Bobby's place," said Kalis.
"But Jaddow's been with you longer," Eric began.
"But you have the knack," interrupted Kalis. "Jaddow doesn't. He'll do fine as a sergeant. You saw how the new men are shaping up. But promoting him any higher would put him in a situation where he would be a liability instead of an asset."
He studied Eric's face a moment. "William wasn't overstating the case about your abilities as a tactician. We'll need to work on your comprehension of strategy as well. You know what's coming, and you know that once the struggle begins, you may find yourself out there with hundreds of men looking to you to keep them alive. An ancient Isolani general called it the fog of battle. And men who can keep other men alive while chaos erupts around them are rare." Eric could only nod. He and the others around him who had travelled with Kalis had seen the army of the Emerald Queen, had been a part of it for a time, and he knew that when that host of hired killers arrived on the shores of the kingdom, chaos would ensue. In the midst of that chaos, only well-trained, disciplined, hard men might survive. And it would be upon those men that the fate of the kingdom, and the rest of the world of Midcamia, would rest, not on the kingdom's traditional armies.
"Very well, Captain, I accept," said Eric.
Kalis smiled and put his hand upon Eric's shoulder.
"You didn't have a choice, Sergeant Major. Now you need to promote some men. We need one more sergeant for the balance of this year, and a half dozen corporals besides."
"Alfred of Darkmoor," said Eric. "He was a corporal and a bully until I got through with him. He's ready to take on the responsibility, and at heart he's still a brawler, and will need that when the time comes."
"You have that right," said Kalis. "Every man a brawler, for that matter."
Eric said, "I suppose we have enough potential corporals around. I'll make up a list this evening."
Kalis nodded.
"I must talk to Patrick before this turns into a full-blown reception," Excuse me.
Rue returned when he saw Kalis leave and asked,
Well, did you get promoted or did Jaddo?
I did, answered Eric.
My condolences, said Rue.
Then he grinned and struck his friend on the arm. Sergeant Major.
What about you?
Asked Eric. You were telling me how things are at home.
Rue smiled weakly and shrugged.
Carly's still upset I took off to go after you on such short notice. And she was right. The children don't recognize me, though Abigail does call me Daddy, and little Elmet just gives shy grins and gurgles.
He sighed. I got a warmer welcome from Helen Jacoby, truth to tell.
Well, from what you told me, she's in your debt. You could have turned her and her children out on the streets.
Rue chewed on a piece of fruit a moment.
Not really. Her husband had no part in the plot to kill my father-in-law.
He shrugged. I've got a few loose ends to tie up. Jason, Duncan, and Lewis have been careful in seeing to my company while I was gone, and my partners in the Bitter Sea Company haven't robbed me too outrageously.
He grinned. At least I haven't found any proof yet.
His expression turned serious again.
And I also know that this army you're about to become a significant part of will need provisions, weapons, and armor. Those don't come cheaply.
Eric nodded. I have some small idea of how we're going to meet the Emerald Queen, and while we'll never put as large a force in the field as she'll send against us, we'll have to mount the most ambitious campaign since the Rift War, and one never matched before.
How many men under arms do you think?
I'm speculating, said Eric, but at least 50,000, 60,000 more than the current armies of the East and West.
That's close to 100,000 men, said Rue. Do we have that many?
No. Eric shook his head. We have 20,000 in all the armies of the West, including the 10,000 directly under the Prince's command. The armies of the East number more, but many of them are honor garrisons. With our long-term peace with Roldum, the other Eastern kingdoms are calm, not willing to try anything without Roldum distracting us.
Eric shrugged. Too much time spent with Lord William, I guess, talking strategy. We now must start building for the battle here.
With a shake of his head, he said softly,
We lost too many of our key men on our last trips to Navindus.
Rue nodded. There's a large debt to be repaid to that green bitch. Then he sighed audibly. And a huge billing to finance it.
Eric smiled. Our duke's getting into your pocket.
Rue returned the smile, though his was far more wry.
Not yet. He's made it clear that taxes will remain reasonable, because he expects me to underwrite a large portion of the coming fight, and to convince others, like Jacob Estabrook, to provide funds as well.
Mentioning Estabrook, Rue again thought of his daughter, Sylvia. Rue's mistress for the better part of a year before his sailing to rescue Eric, Kalis, and the others. He had seen her only once since returning 2 weeks ago, and he was planning on seeing her tonight. He ached for her.
I think I should call upon Jacob soon, he said, as if the thought had just come to him. If he and I together agree to participate in financing the war, no one else of importance in the kingdom would refuse the prince's request.
Dryly, he added, After all, if we fail in this, repayment of loans will be the last of our worries. Then he whispered in a somber tone, Assuming we can worry about anything. Eric nodded noncommittally. He had to admit that Rue had proven beyond any doubt he understood matters of finance far better than Eric, and should his phenomenal success be any indication, better than most of the businessmen in the kingdom.
Rue said, I should make me excuses to the prince and get about my own business. I suspect those of us here who are not part of your military inner circle will be asked to find other things to go do soon anyway.
Eric took his hand.
I think you're right.
Other nobles, not part of the military, were presenting themselves to the prince. Rue left his boyhood friend and joined the line of those begging the prince's leave to depart, and soon only the prince, his senior advisers, and members of the military remained. When Owen Greylock entered, Patrick said, "We're now all here." Knight Marshal William motioned for them to gather around a circular table at the far end of the room. Duke James sat to his prince's right, and William to the left. It was the Duke who began.
"Well, now the pomp is over, we can get back to the bloody work ahead of us."
Eric sat back and listened to the plans for the final defence of the kingdom begin to take shape. Rue reached the gate where his horse was waiting for him. He had left his carriage at home for his wife's use, for he had moved his family to an estate outside the gates of the city. While he preferred the convenience of his townhouse across the street from Barrett's coffee house, where most of his business day was spent, the country house offered a tranquillity he couldn't have imagined before the move. He had grounds for hunting, if he chose, and a stream with fish, and all the other advantages granted to the nobility and rich commoners. He knew he would have to find time soon to enjoy those pastimes. Not yet 23 years of age, Rue Avery was the father of two, one of the richest merchants in the kingdom, and privy to secrets shared by few. The country house was also a hedge, as the gamblers called it, a place from which his family could escape the oncoming invasion to safer refuge to the east before the mob fled the city, trampling everything in its path. Rue had endured the destruction of Mahata, the distant city crushed 3 years before by the armies of the Emerald Queen. He had been forced to fight his way through the mass of panic-stricken citizens, had seen innocents die because they were in the wrong place. He vowed he would spare his children that horror, no matter what else might come. He knew what he had been told, years before, along with the rest of Kalis's company, on the shore of that distant land called Navindus, that should the Kingdom of the Isles not prevail, all life as they knew it would cease on Midcamia. He still couldn't accept that deep within, but he acted as if it were true. He had seen too many things on his trip south to know that even if the captain's claims were overblown, life under the yoke of the Emerald Queen's advancing army would bring only a choice between death and slavery. He also knew that if that event should come to pass, which the captain warned of, the invading army reaching some unnamed goal, then whatever preparations he made would be meaningless. But short of that, he was determined to take whatever steps necessary to keep his wife and children alive and away from harm. He had purchased a townhouse in Salador, presently used by an agent he had hired to run his affairs in the Eastern Realm, and he would probably buy another in the city of Ran, on the kingdom's eastern frontier. He was next going to inquire of foreign agents in the east about the availability of property in distant Roldum, the island kingdom most closely allied with the Kingdom of the Isles. Gathering his thoughts, he realized he was halfway to his office. He had told Carly he would spend the night at the townhouse, claiming that the affairs at the palace would force him to work late into the night. The truth was, he was going to send a message to Sylvia Estabrook, asking to see her tonight. Since returning from rescuing Eric and the others, he had thought of little else. Images of her body haunted his dreams, and memories of her scent and the soft feel of her skin made him unable to think of more important things. The one night he had spent with her after his return only reinforced his hunger to be with her. He reached his office and rode through the gate, past workmen hurriedly attempting to finish the improvements to the property he had ordered when first back from his sea voyage. a second story was being added to the old warehouse. A loft, actually, where he could conduct business without being on the busy warehouse floor. His staff was growing, and he needed more room. He had already made an offer for a piece of property adjoining his at the rear, and would have to completely tear down an old block of apartments rented to workmen and their families, and then build new facilities. He paid too much, he knew, but he was desperate for the space. He dismounted and motioned for one of the workers to take his horse.
"Give him some hay, no grain," he instructed, as he made his way past wagons being loaded and unloaded. "Then saddle another horse and have it ready for me."
Workers repairing broken wheels and replacing shoes on draft animals set up a raucous hammering, and men shouted instructions to one another across the floor. Overseeing the chaos were two men, Luis de Savona, Rue's companion from the early days of Kalis's company of desperate men, and Jason, a former waiter at Barrett's, who had been the first there to befriend Rue, and who was also a genius with figures. Rue smiled.
"Where's Duncan?" Luis shrugged. "Abed with some whore, probably."
It was midday, and Rue shook his head. His cousin was reliable in certain ways, but in others he had no sense of loyalty. Still, there were only a handful of men in the world Rue would trust at his back in a knife fight, and Duncan was one of them.
"What news?" asked Rue.
Jason held out a large document.
"Our attempt to establish a regular route to Great Kesh is under consideration. According to this very wordy document that just arrived from the Keshian Trade Legate's office. We are, however, welcome to bid on odd jobs as they come to our attention."
He said that. "Not in so many words," said Lewis. "Since we took over the operation of Jacoby and Sons, I halfway expected we'd keep their regular clients."
"We have," said Jason. "Except for the Keshian merchants."
He shook his head, his young features a mask of solemnity. "Once it became known you'd taken over on Helen Jacoby's behalf, every Keshian trading concern began cancelling contracts as fast as possible." Rue frowned. Tapping his chin with his finger, he asked,
"Who's getting those contracts?"
Luis said, "Estabrook." Rue turned and stared at his friend, who continued. "At least, either companies he holds a minor interest in, or ones owned by men he's had major influence over. You know he was doing a lot of business with the Jacobies before you finished with them."
Rue glanced at Jason. "What did you find when you went over the Jacoby accounts?"
Jason had thoroughly investigated all those accounts while Rue had sailed across the sea to rescue Eric. Rue had killed Randolph and Timothy Jacoby when they had tried to ruin him, and rather than put Randolph Jacoby's wife, Helen, and their children out on the streets, he had agreed to run Jacoby and Sons on her behalf. Jason said, "Whatever business Jacoby and Estabrook had, there was little record-keeping involved. There were some minor contracts, but nothing out of the ordinary. Just a few odd personal notes I can't make sense of. But one thing doesn't fit."
"What?" asked Rue.
"The Jacobies were too rich. There was gold accounted to them in several counting houses that, well, I don't know where it came from. I have accounts going back 10 years. He waved at a pile of ledgers on the floor nearby. "And there's just no source for it."
Rue nodded. "Smuggling."
He remembered his first confrontation with Tim Jacoby over some smuggled silk Rue had managed to get his hands on.
"How much gold?"
Jason said, "More than 30,000 sovereigns. And I haven't found every account yet."
Rue considered silently for a minute.
"Don't say anything about this to anyone. If you have any reason to speak to Ellen Jacoby, just tell her things are going better than we'd thought. Keep it vague. Just enough solid information to reassure her that she and her children are protected for life, no matter what happens to me. And ask her if she needs anything.
Aren't you going to see her? Asked Lewis.
Soon. He glanced around. We need to build more resources, and fast. So start keeping your ears open for businesses we can buy into or take over outright. But keep it quiet. Any mention of the name Avery and Son, or the Bitter Sea Company, and prices will rise faster than a spring flood. The others acknowledged his instructions, and Rue said, I'm going next to Barrett's to see me partners, and if I'm needed, that's where you'll find me for the balance of the day. Rue left his associates and mounted his fresh horse. As he considered what he had been told, he reached Barrett's coffee house before he knew it. Rue dismounted, tossing the reins to one of the waiters. He pulled a silver coin from his vest and handed it to the boy. "Stable him behind me house, Richard." The youngster led the mount away, smiling. Rue made it a point to remember the names of all the waitstaff at Barrett's and to tip lavishly. He had been employed there only 3 years before and knew how difficult the work could be. Besides, if he needed something from a waiter, a message carried across town, or a special dish prepared for a business associate, he got quick service in exchange for his largesse. Rue moved past the first rail as another waiter quickly opened the gate for him, then made his way to the stairs up to the balcony overlooking the central part of the floor. His partners, Jerome Masterson and Stanley Hume, were waiting for him. He took his seat and said, Gentlemen. Jerome said,
Rupert, a pleasant morning to you.
Hume echoed the greeting, and they began to conduct the morning business of the Bitter Sea Company, the largest trading concern in the Kingdom of the Isles.